You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail.
The sunrise, and at 5 a.m. you get on the bus. The people look so resigned to the daily grind, and you swear it'll never be you. You said that you were new in town.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Intersections, presented by CITR's Intersectionality Collective. We're here at CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m., we host a panel of collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, sexuality, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
The city living is ugly.
In this episode, we are joined by Zachary Tharp, a previous outreach worker with Healthier Masculinities, a division of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, or SASC.
So just to start out, could you describe some of the work that you did with Healthier Masculinities and what kind of the goals of that was?
So I started in the summer of 2020, I guess, and I think the main, the reason they had talked to me and the way I'd kind of made a name for myself was that I came from a fraternity background, and I'd worked with Greek life before, and being in Greek life, I'd kind of understood some of the dynamics in fraternities. So they asked me to kind of come on and work on presentations and better facilitating relationship with Greek life through presentation about consent culture and intersectionality, as well as anti-colonial framework talks and presentations, as well as some presentations with the general public. For the most part, it was great. I really enjoyed my time there. But I think it was just, time to kind of move on more fresh faces, and I still have my classes. But overall, I worked on presentations and kind of community outreach.
And you mentioned that you came from a fraternity background. Could you speak a little bit more to what specifically happened with trying to kind of create a relationship between Healthier Masculinities and fraternity culture?
Yeah. So I guess when it came to the Healthier Masculinities program and Greek life, especially fraternities, it was a lot about partying and understanding how alcohol can kind of influence decision making and party dynamics for Greek life, especially during the pandemic. It was, there wasn't any parties or anything, so they're kind of focusing on having their newer members coming in with just presentations right off the bat and teaching the newer members kind of what, are kind of setting a good foundation for newer members to kind of understand how toxic masculinity can be, kind of co-opted with drinking culture. And that really was what they are kind of coming from. From the SASC, our perspective was more that we wanted to kind of set the framework for, other presentations and other community groups. So we started with Greek life and started to try to build a rapport with them so that we could branch off to all of IFC and other social clubs that reached out to us. And within that, we kind of had presentations for them and they would listen. And we tried to have some engagement through breakout rooms and discussion, basically, and I would kind of facilitate that. But for the most part, it was kind of preparing future our current members who just kind of started during the pandemic to kind of understand what party culture was like and kind of set like some good examples of what to do in certain scenarios and stuff that they might not have been exposed to in high school. And coming into university, we felt it was very important that we could teach like the first years right off the bat what they could do in difficult situations and scenarios that might come up in parties that would be, you know, happening when things reopened.
And that kind of goes hand in hand with UBC's somewhat complicated history of having some sexual assault cases, claims, allegations, as well as the systemic sexism that has been looked at within the university. Why do you think that healthier masculinities came from that need for it, or why it's necessary for an establishment like UBC to have such a program that promotes healthy masculinity?
I think it's necessary, one, just because I feel like some of the knowledge coming from some of these groups in these scenarios can be lacking at times from certain members or situations. Ideally, you know, I would say when I was working there that eventually I would hope to not have this job and that like the community and the mindset of individuals would change so that this job was no longer needed. But yes, it kind of came out of need to support survivors and kind of, I guess, you know, work proactively. I guess if we can hopefully teach new members, which are basically the future of Greek life, these valuable skills in just understanding consent and drinking culture and some of the negative elements of Greek life, that maybe over time that these members would, you know, mature and they would take away from the presentations that we have like positive ideas of what healthy masculinity could be, and that eventually they would themselves be in leadership roles and I guess teaching positions to teach the next members, and then it would continue on and hopefully work at a proactive level versus a reactive and I guess the support level is good, and that's what we also did, but kind of working on both ends where you're teaching it so that it doesn't happen, as well as supporting the victim and like not even that, but like supporting the Greek life and university in their like efforts to kind of teach new new members. I guess that the university was really pushing to having new members kind of learning a bit more than what they had before. Before it wasn't really much. It was just, you know, this is what consent is. This is, you know, you're gonna have parties, be responsible, and that was it. And the university did like more of a hands-off approach at the time. Then when the Healthy Masculinity program started, I think that was like 2015, 2016, in the wake of a lot of these lawsuits and issues that have been going on, especially with over the past few years pre-pandemic, there was a few points where tensions were hot, but the SAS was really hoping to kind of, I don't know, get ahead of it and make sure that these things didn't continue to happen. Obviously, they had a support, but we wanted to make sure that it didn't happen at all.
Absolutely. And going off of that, how did kind of creating a space that was specifically kind of a community for masculinity and talking about masculine ideas and ideologies help to kind of facilitate these conversations about topics that aren't necessarily normally covered in depth?
Yeah, I think like that's kind of where I started. So they had the same issue where they're trying to figure out how to reach these groups and kind of see them eye to eye. A lot of times the groups are seeing like, oh, we're getting lectured at, we don't really care. And you know, you don't really understand where, you know, Greek life. So they, you know, I came around when they needed a Greek perspective. And at the time, or right before I had left my fraternity to kind of branch off and leave some of that toxic Greek elements. And at the time when I left, I was the mental health officer position, where I'd been trying to teach like my fellow Greek members and fraternity brothers, like understanding why these like different issues that my Greek fraternity had, and I was coming from the United States on the East Coast, and there was still a lot of the same issues. So I, you know, worked with several of my fraternity brothers to kind of understand why these issues were happening. And it seemed like the overarching thing was that it was just like this idea that you had to be the tough guy and, you know, the alpha, you know, fraternity member, and kind of, you know, having these weird expectations for how you should be acting as a man, as, you know, what they would say, like, you know, be a man and whatnot. And coming here, I was approached by the SASC about my perspectives and understanding why these notions were the case. And I kind of just came to them with my personal experience and understanding that like Greek life, a lot of it is partying, and obviously there's brotherhood and community engagement, but you know, it's college and people want to, you know, have fun. So these party dynamics were really where we kind of tried to drive it home, as well as meeting with them with Greek references and engaging presentations where it's, you know, it's serious and we want, you know, people to learn from them and be honest and everything, or like be honest and kind of have something to take away from it. So we kind of met with a humorous element as well as a personal element. And I talked about my experiences in Greek life, and I showed them pictures of me and stuff like that. So like people understood that, you know, oh, he was in Greek life, he's not making this up. You know, he has the experience, you know, and it's not just like, oh, some small fraternity or like a business fraternity or something. No, it's like, it's a real fraternity. And I had a lot of the similar experiences that UBC Greek Life had, and that kind of allowed like a mutual understanding from the Greek community, because I understood where they were coming from, so they were willing to kind of engage more with where I was coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have a liaison that kind of can understand both sides of the story going into it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so going into that, a lot of kind of the topics about talking about kind of sex and gender and stuff like that tries to recognize the role that masculinity plays in terms of sexual relationships, especially. Why do you think that it was so important for healthier masculinity to kind of recognize that element of how masculinity affects relationships and what kind of power dynamics that it can cause?
I think it was important just because it come like being, you know, having healthier masculinity not only can better support you call it survivors of sexualized violence, but also kind of, I don't know, I want to say quell the notions that some masculine identifying people have, and especially, you know, again, Greek life, especially fraternities, some of these dynamics that are at play can be not only bad for people who are in the immediate vicinity of someone who might have sort of toxic masculine traits, but also those people themselves. I think that everyone, you know, has the chance to be a better person. Everyone should always strive to try to be the best of themselves. And I think, you know, kind of working from the healthier masculinity's elements kind of helped, I don't know, people communicate where they might've been you know, making mistakes and doing something that they wouldn't necessarily always agree with. And I think really working with people from a just a person-to-person element was really important, just to kind of establish good relationships. And hopefully, you know, when people feel better about themselves and they feel supported by a community of their peers, they can bring new ideas and better relationships to their own life. And I think that is kind of where we are coming from, just creating a place where anyone who identifies as masculine or in that immediate sphere of, you know, influence, they could feel heard, not feel judged for past mistakes, and hopefully unlearn certain negative elements that they had had in their mindset when it came to masculinity.
And with that, you also mentioned that it comes from an inclusive perspective, looking at anti-colonialism and other aspects of trying to bring in inclusivity. Can you talk a little bit about how they centralized privilege and any kind of sort of privilege, white privilege, male privilege, at the centers of these conversations?
Yes. From the get-go, it was land acknowledgments were probably the first thing that we would have in each presentation, but then we would move to decolonization and decolonial mindsets and kind of set the stage for how there could be an intersection between colonization of the land that we are presenting from and that UBC is situated on, but also the colonization of people's bodies and the mindset of conquest and male conquest. This comes, you know, these toxic traits, how they could potentially be all intertwined amongst each other, and kind of slowly but surely peeling back each layer, understanding where privilege meets colonialism and where male privilege meets you know, intersectionalities, and how, you know, white privilege and male privilege, they can be separate, but also intertwined and lead towards colonialism. And then kind of peeling each layer back, understanding how these layers are involved in our daily kind of life and everything, and then understanding how we can, as individuals, acknowledge that and then begin the process of unlearning. So a lot of times I would start this section with my own experiences in Greek life, and I would often talk about this scenario where I was really into like this movie called Animal House, and that was a big Greek movie, and there's this infamous scene in the movie that at the time, you know, when it came out in like the 70s, 80s, no one really bat an eye, but now, it, you know, looking back, it's about like the main character deciding whether or not he wants to engage in sexual activity with one of these people at a toga party, and the person's completely passed out, and it's not a good scene. But I talk about how, like, you know, I thought it was a funny scene at the time, and a lot of people did, and it was a quintessential Greek life movie, but then it took on new meaning when I started to do more digging into why Greek life had some of these bad, you know, conceptions, and why is some of these things happening only in Greek life? There's other social groups, but by and large, fraternities had, you know, disproportionately, or not even disproportionately, but just a lot of these major issues that have been coming about, and a lot of survivors coming forward talking about how the culture of Greek life had permitted this, facilitated this, and we, and especially me, want to kind of get to the bottom of it, basically. And by talking about the intersectionality and white privilege and male privilege, and giving my own experiences about male privilege and just where I was coming from, a lot of people to kind of, we all were able to read, come to like one set of agreement of like, okay, these are what, you know, this is what white privilege kind of does. This is what male privilege can entail. And where do we go from that? And then it's up to the individual to kind of take away certain concepts. Some people might lean more towards the white privilege part and try to expand on that. And then other people might go down the decolonial route. But it was always from the perspective of you as the individual making the right choices, even if, you know, and being okay being wrong sometimes. Just coming from different perspectives, it was always okay to, you know, be wrong and unlearn some, you know, negative notions that you might have had. So no one's ever like a bad person going into it. It's, you know, about what you do now that you have this knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And learning is such an important concept that in any of it's a vital concept, really. And so when looking at kind of sex in general and kind of looking at sex in society, a lot of sort of masculinity comes around the idea of traditional social sex scripts that people have to follow. Did you guys talk about those in Healthy Masculinities and what kind of the roles of masculinity in the like traditional media sense of it does to people in sexual relationships?
Yeah, we did do a lot of work, especially because I feel that a lot more people kind of understand or can kind of understand it easier when they see it in pop culture and stuff. So like people, I would often have a lot of references to movies, as I just mentioned, and you know, TV shows and stuff that would come up. And even like as recently as, honestly, it was like Too Hot to Handle and stuff on Netflix would often kind of come up and we'd kind of discuss why is this person saying it? Like, you know, obviously it's reality TV and people are going to say, you know, the craziest things to get watched, but where are they coming from? Because obviously, you know, there is some little nugget of truth buried beneath these statements. And we would try to understand like, why are these people saying this? Like, where did you learn this? And a lot of times it is just from TV. And if, you know, we kind of explain that if you can learn it from TV, then you can unlearn it with communication and knowledge, as you said. So like, you know, knowledge is power, and understanding that that these notions are in fact learned from somewhere. It's not some innate thing that you're just born with, and these sexual scripts come from what we see on the internet and TV. We can kind of show where we might have learned it, and then here are some references on good, you know, good dynamics and good sexual scripts. So a lot of times we are maybe towards the end as I kind of discovered more, but we would start with a few Netflix things and a few things on TV, and then I would kind of end with more positive shows. So I remember watching an episode of Queer Eye for our presentations, and I would pull up some clips of, you know, positive affirmations and positive relationships from like Queer Eye, or RuPaul's Drag Race was a good one that I loved to watch, and kind of having positive relationships sprinkled in and showing that it's like, oh, you know, we see negative stuff on TV, we learn these things from TV and the internet, but if you want to just learn in the same way, here are some positive things you can watch that would show the other side and show how some of these negative things can be bad. And, you know, listening to people talk about their testimony in relation to certain things that we see or talk about on TV. So as I said before, the Animal House scene was quite instrumental in hearing that. It's like, oh, you know, you have one person saying that, you know, they should, you know, be, you know, doing these bad things, and another person saying it's not a good thing to do, and kind of seeing where these scripts are coming from, basically, you know, understanding and finding where they actually originate from can, you know, give you a better understanding of where to go next and how to unlearn them, basically. So unlearning was a big element of our teaching.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And especially giving positive examples to learn from. That's one that you don't often hear about in the process of unlearning. And so kind of to wrap it, what healthy masculinity did, you guys also mentioned a lot about the focus of consent as one of these conversations that was really vitally important to have. Can you share more about kind of what those conversations around consent looked like and what they were targeting?
Yeah. It started very simplistically, just like, you know, asking to give someone a hug and kind of, you know, stuff like that, and kind of, I don't know, making it easy to understand, because some people didn't even know like what consent in the concept of just everyday life was like. And because it's not really, I guess, like, you know, sometimes people don't really think of it as consenting to, you know, give someone a hug and stuff like that. And we kind of just break it down into a very simplistic way that people can really understand. And really kind of like, oh, okay, well, that obviously that, you know, that makes sense. And then you work your way up to more complex scenarios. So a lot of it, that was kind of like our breakout room talk, where it's like, can people come up with three everyday consent things? And it's like, oh, okay, you know, you said this and such said that. And I went into breakout room, whatever, and they were saying, having a whole conversation about, you know, consent at in class and studying and stuff like that. So we kind of worked from a very simplistic view and kind of built up to more complex scenarios, mostly involving alcohol and social scenarios, just because I felt and the SASC felt that it would be most applicable and most beneficial for Greek life and fraternities specifically, to kind of come with a mindset where it's like, okay, what can I gain from this? And it's like, what can we, you know, portray for fraternities that they're going to want to listen because they know they can benefit from the future? So I, you know, kind of talked about having, you know, a better reputation. So in Greek life, especially certain fraternities, having a good reputation is a really big deal, and you don't want to be the bad frat and stuff. So kind of framing that in a way that they can come away from this, and having other groups and other social organizations on campus seeing them as leaders amongst, you know, being very knowledgeable in consent culture and being allies of survivors of sexualized violence and stuff like that. We could, you know, they could benefit from it by understanding what we're saying. And that was really a big thing. So it's kind of, you know, having the carrot in front of them, kind of like, okay, you know, you can be known for this and people would love you if you did this. And here's, we're going to give you all the tools so you can be the best frat on campus. And that's kind of like where we were coming at. And when it came to consent, that was just another tool in the toolbox that we really want to push forward, especially for just the SASC itself. We really wanted to push consent, and that was a big topic for a lot of our meetings and presentations.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great kind of method of dangling the carrot in front of people in order to motivate them. That, again, you don't often hear about, but it does work. And so just wrapping up our conversation, on a personal note, what do you think that the most significant thing that you learned from your experiences with healthy masculinities might have been?
Ooh, that's a good question. I can't speak on a specific exact thing, but I will say that being at the SASC, even though I was there to be teaching people, I still feel like I learned just as much from the audience and my fellow colleagues at the SASC than just as much as I was teaching others. So it was really enjoyable hearing testimonials and stories from people about their experiences. And when someone would have like an aha moment where it's like, oh, wow, that was what, you know, the patriarchy was trying to say, or that's why I was feeling this way, because I was always trying to, you know, be a cool guy or whatever. And that's what really made it worthwhile. And the knowledge that I gained from my colleagues and what they would tell me, and, you know, how to implement certain things or stuff that they would want to, hear from Greek life was really, really kind of what got me really involved and really excited about what I did. So really having, seeing the aha moments in people's faces and the stories that people would tell me about, they learned X, Y, and Z from this presentation, and they were able to, you know, convince another fraternity member at a party. It's like, oh, you know, you remember what we taught, you know, we learned this week from the SASC, and, you know, stuff like that was really important. And I really valued that as my experience at the SASC.
Absolutely. That sounds like an incredible experience to go through learning mm-hmm. teaching perspective. And so kind of just going forward, Healthy Masculinities, it's still available for people to look to. Do you have any other outside resources that you would recommend to people who are hoping to learn more about Healthy Masculinity?
Aside from definitely checking out the SASC website, that's a big one. There's also partnerships with WAVA, and there's also, looking out to potential leaders. I know the SASC is pretty good at kind of reaching out and sharing knowledge that they have. So I would definitely reach out to any of the educators or support workers there, as well as any of the groups there. Even on campus with the rest of the AMS, you know, peer support can be good, and just kind of reaching out to those groups would definitely really help. And really just kind of, I would say the WAVA and the SASC are probably going to be the two go-tos that I would have. I would just recommend anyone just kind of doing some Googling, seeing communities near them, even looking on Facebook if there's, you know, groups that, you know, talk about that. Sometimes there's like book clubs that are oriented towards healthy masculinities or toxic masculinity. Groups that, like, you know, they talk about what that is. It's more of a informal friend based thing, but I would definitely recommend, you know, doing some research like that. The educators are very knowledgeable, so I'd recommend going there first.
Yeah, those are great resources to recommend as well. So that kind of brings me to the end of my formal questions for you, but do you have any other thoughts that you wanted to share, or that anything that we didn't address?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the SASC is having its 20th anniversary this year, in a few weeks, or next week, I think. And that's something that really exciting. I can't believe it's been around for 20 years now. And I would say the organization has been really growing and adapting post-COVID. During the time I was there, that was definitely a time of great change. And the pandemic, you know, having people, you know, moving away, just, you know, Vancouver is so expensive. So everyone could afford to stay. And, you know, the SASC is, you know, even though it has adequate funding, I would say it's just that, just, you know, it could always do for more funding and expanding. And the university desperately, you know, needs more and more resources like this and more and more organizations that are devoted to supporting students, you know. I have, Lord knows there's enough financial services, and you hear about, you know, the university always trying to get more money, but I think having more organizations and more funding towards existing organizations that support students, especially in something that is, can be seen as a very vulnerable and very difficult conversation, I think the SASC definitely has a lot of utility in that, where it's, you know, the groups on campus, organizations on campus that are there to have those difficult conversations. And that's really what the SASC kind of is really well adapted to, and having those difficult conversations. And the people there are very welcoming. I don't know what it is, but they have some innate thing that everyone, like, it is very easy to talk to anyone working there. So I think that the SASC is a very invaluable resource on campus.
Absolutely. And we'll leave links and everything as well, so that people can find those resources with us. And so that brings me to kind of the end of my interview. I want to say thank you so much for talking.
Of course. Yeah.
You gave an enormous wealth of knowledge and perspective in this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to change the state of the world? But instead, you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community. Megamall's debut EP, Escape from Lizard City, goes live on Friday, July 1st. Buy the cassette and lyric book on Bandcamp or stream wherever you listen to music. For the last 2.5 years, you could avoid everyone except yourself. Welcome to Lizard City.
Every Friday at noon, CITR takes you on a journey through Thunderbird Radioland. A journey of sound and song, of words and music, of the now and then, of the right here and the far away. It's the Eclectic Lunch, every Friday at 12 noon, on Thunderbird Radio, 101.9 FM in beautiful Vancouver.
Welcome to Intersections. This is Phoebe, and also here with me is collective member Juliana.
Hi.
So going off of our sex episode that we did a couple weeks ago for Sexual Health Awareness Week and, you know, February, Valentine's Day, Love Month, we today have a couple really awesome guests we're going to be talking to about the topic of sex. So with us today, we're very lucky to have Sophia Green. Sophia is a sexual health educator and feminist researcher. They provide sex education beyond the binary with a focus on pleasure, liberation, and exploration. Areas of expertise include sexual and gender identities, consent, community building, and gender-based violence prevention. They hold a BA and MA in sociology, volunteer for Students for Consent Culture, and have been working in gender justice for over 9 years. Welcome to the show, Sophia.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here.
I'll say too, Sophia is also my friend. I think I have this thing where I just bring my friends on this show, but it makes the conversations very fun and enjoyable. And I'm, what can I say? I have very cool friends.
It's truly an honor to be Phoebe's friend, I must say.
Okay, so let's just dive right into sort of our first introductory topic. Sophia, we wanted to ask you, you know, with your expertise on sex ed, about some of like the limitations of standardized sex ed and maybe the sex ed that I'm sure a lot of us grew up having. In our episode, we have some conversations about those of us who grew up in, you know, religious schools and had abstinence-only educations. That's Juliana raising her hand right there. So what's left out of the conversation when talking about sexual health and sex ed, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I think a lot of times when we talk about sex ed in public schools, we think, okay, at least some topics are being covered, like how to use a condom and like what STIs can happen, right? But essentially, even though we have somewhat of a attempt at sexual health education in British Columbian public schools, which is the curriculum I'm most familiar with. We unfortunately have sex ed in our physical education curriculum, which means that it is often like physical education teachers who are doing the lessons. And this can be great. However, when you do like a kinesiology degree, sex ed isn't really something that you're often being really well versed in. Like the programs we're putting teachers through are not comprehensive and they're not being trained adequately. And so you do often have a lot of teachers who are just feeling really ill-equipped with being able to deliver sex ed. Obviously, you mentioned abstinence-only courses for sex ed are, I mean, to me, that's like, that's anti-sex ed. So you have a lot of shame built into those types of lessons. You have a lot of moral values being placed on different sexual and romantic behaviors for people. Obviously, abstinence-only is also a very like heteronormative and like patriarchal presentation of like indoctrination, to be honest. So all these different ways we talk about sex ed are, you know, really failing students and also like the community in general, because when you have a population that doesn't understand how to communicate their needs, how to communicate consent and therefore access safety for themselves, you have a lot of like higher risk for violence, higher risk for STI transmission, and general just poor sexual wellness. So another problem too is that British Columbia's public education curriculum is often seen as quite progressive. And so we have like the Yukon as well as Alberta following suit with like what our curriculum presents. But again, it's there's a lot of really missing, a lot of big missing pieces in our curriculum. So if you look at like the curriculum sheet, they're very, very minor pieces within the health curriculum that actually talks about sex ed. So if you are if you're a teacher, you're an educator who, you know, has really got a good background in sexual health, you can really finesse a lot of good education into the curriculum. But unfortunately, if you don't have those resources, which is the overwhelming majority, then students are being left in the dark. And another thing I would think is really worth mentioning too is that parents by large, like really do want their students to have this information. Like a majority of parents want their kids to have adequate sexual health education. And many of them also feel ill-equipped to be delivering any sort of talk with their kids as well. So a lot of people will err on the side of caution, which means they're not even having these discussions with their kids at home. So obviously this means that, you know, young people who are looking for information are going to the internet, which can be a really great resource, but also has a lot of like hateful content on it as well, like misogynistic and racist content. And of course, people looking to like mainstream pornography for understanding how to engage in sex, which of course, porn does have some interesting stuff going on for sure. But it is more of like a recreational thing. It's not an educational tool. So
thank you. Thank you for that very comprehensive answer. Like there's so much from that we can unpack. But the first thing that, you know, stands out to me is how do you think that all those issues can be addressed? You know, how could the province address the problems with our sex ed curriculum in schools?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, off the top of my head, I would say that a solution would be just redoing how we deliver sexual health education and also offering like really comprehensive like professional development programs for teachers. Obviously, like schools and districts will have their own like pro D funds where they are able to bring in like sex educators on like a pro D day. And maybe I think this is maybe one of the more sustainable ways to do it is to actually teach the teachers who are already in schools how to deliver this kind of education. Unfortunately, the funds and also just like the awareness around sex ed isn't really there yet. So, but in a dream world, I see sexual health education being delivered as a consistent program from like grades 1 and 2, where we're talking about consent and autonomy and like body parts, all the way to grade 12. Because also another problem with BC is that the requirements for sex ed stop at grade 10. And grade 10, 11, 12, that's when you're most likely to be sexually active as a teen. So I see an ideal future having like a sexual health course being a mandatory course that is inclusively taught. And when I say inclusively taught, I mean you've got a diverse range of teachers doing the education from different backgrounds, And you've got whole units on identity and on oppression and on liberation and on pleasure as well, because pleasure is something that's really not discussed in sexual health for public schools.
Yeah, you know, I noticed that, you know, in your bio that you focus on pleasure, liberation, exploration. And, you know, you're saying now that that's missing from typical sex ed. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that and why you think those are so important to include in sex education.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. It's a good prompt. I think pleasure to me is one of the most integral components of sexual health, because most of the time when you're having sex, you're not having sex to conceive. That's just statistically what's going on. And a lot of people are interested in conceiving. And so what do we use sex for? We use sex for, you know, expressing ourselves, gaining intimacy with people, building connections, de-stressing, getting a better night's sleep. Like, there are so many utilities in sex, and at the forefront of all of those is the goal of achieving pleasure of some kind. So when we are teaching sex ed from a really like pathological or like pathologizing, I should say, perspective, where we're like, this is what an STI outbreak looks like. It's very dangerous and you'll die. Like, if I'm thinking of like the Mean Girls scene with the teacher being like, don't have sex, you're like, you'll get pregnant and die or whatever. I'm misquoting, but you know what I mean? So when we have that perspective, you're setting up, I think, kids and youth and students and adults up for failure, because they're thinking, okay, sex is this thing where I might get in trouble. I'm going to be judged by, you know, my religious deity or my parents or whatever. And then you've got shame built into it. If you're only looking at like sex with its risks, its associated risks, being pregnancy, violence, and STIs. So I think a really liberating practice in sex ed is to say like, hey, this is how you can communicate with your partner what you want and what feels good to you. Because what feels good to you is going to be different with like your future partners, your past and present partners. It's going to be different from what you're seeing in movies and on TV and what you hear from your friends. And so having the capacity and the understanding of how to communicate your needs and express what feels good and what doesn't is also, I think, really integral to accessing pleasure and also just having like a well-rounded sex life.
I'm glad you brought up, you know, the focus of STIs in sex ed, especially in schools, to like transition us nicely to the next topic we wanted to talk to you about, which is sort of about STI status and disclosure. If Jules, you want to sort of take it away.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for all that information. That was very interesting to listen to you talk. Hopping back quickly to one of the things, the Mean Girl quote that you said, that was largely my experience. Like, that just quote summed up like my experience with sex ed. I did go to like a Christian school, so abstinence was taught. And as you said, like shame and the risks were kind of the only things taught and not the good side of sex or sexual health. And I remember specifically learning a lot about STIs and how like awful they were, and just how like, you know, the shame associated it with something that like that was very ingrained. And it wasn't even until like a couple, like recently in the past few years, that I've started having open conversations with friends and kind of like destigmatizing that in my own life. But we were hoping to kind of chat with you about the like, I feel like STIs are kind of destigmatized, but they're also kind of not. It's like they exist in this weird space in the sexual health world. Do you have any thoughts on like the benefits and certain like the benefits or drawbacks about the way STIs are normalized or destigmatized, or the way they're not normalized or destigmatized in like this current sexual health era? Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. No, it's a great question, and thank you also for sharing like your personal experience. I mean, it's definitely a tough place to come from. So I appreciate you sharing that. I've got a few thoughts. I think you're right when you said that we are in a very specific sort of era of sexual health where people are now discussing STIs. People are talking about how they're going in for their regular screenings, and these are all amazing like trends, right? Like it's what we want to see. I would say when we aren't talking about STIs in a regular setting, in a destigmatized or like normalized way, you end up seeing like increased rates of STI transmissions. Again, increased rates of shame. And when people are afraid of STIs, when there's not a lot of education going on, because every sexually transmitted infection is treatable, right? Some don't have a cure, but every single STI has a treatment. So you can live a long, healthy life with an STI. Absolutely. This includes HIV. This includes herpes, two viruses that don't have a cure, right? So these are really manageable things we have now. As long as you have access to healthcare, you can live a really long and happy life with a happy and long and diverse sex life. But when we have sex ed that shows us like these really graphic images of like a rash or STI infection, which, by the way, I do feel the need to mention, those are always medical outliers. They do not represent what a regular STI infection looks like. So it's very misleading. It makes people, if they've got some symptoms, but not like a really intense rash, they're not going to go in for a screening. And this obviously is a problem. But when you have the STI conversation being more normalized and more common, you have people more likely to go in for a screening. So even when they're not exhibiting any symptoms, having like a checkup every 3 months, like a blood and a urine panel and maybe some swabs if that's relevant to you, that will just be more common for people, because a huge barrier to getting STI screens is just fear of a diagnosis. So if someone, especially for herpes, because herpes is one of those ones, of course, we don't have a cure for herpes or HSV2 or HSV1. Is there a medical term for herpes? One of the huge barriers for people going in to get a diagnosis is just, okay, I'd rather just think it's an ingrown hair. I'd rather think it's this or that, instead of going in and having a swab and getting a confirmation and then being put on a treatment plan. So, yeah.
It is. It's great listening and hearing you talk, because I feel like I was just thinking in my head, I was like, oh my God, if this was what my sex ed was like back in the day, like, you know, so many questions, or like, I would just be so much more well-informed. On the flip side of that, in our last episode, we were kind of talking about the fact that maybe a bit more people know that STIs are treatable, and there's more people going in for checkups, and it's kind of less stigmatized, or like it's just like more openly talked about a little bit. That's potentially led to people not caring as much if they get one, which could maybe lead to less preventative measures being taken. Is that something that you would say like rings true, or that you've seen in your work? Is that something that you would say is true or no? What are your thoughts on that?
It's an interesting question, because I think the if you follow through that line of thinking, it goes, okay, well, if STIs are so normalized, people won't really take them seriously, right? That's kind of like the thesis of that. And I think I haven't run into people being so laissez-faire about getting an STI that they don't care at all. I think no matter what, having the information is going to make you a more informed person who can make decisions for their bodies and for their partner's bodies, like more informed consent, more power behind their decision making. So I haven't seen like a trend where people think it's so normal that they're unwilling to use a condom, for instance, or any other sort of barrier method to prevent STIs. I think it's kind of, I would rather say the opposite, actually. I would say the more normalized it is, the more likely people are going to have conversations and are more likely to volunteer their sexual health history, which includes like what partners they've been with, what behaviors they've been engaging in, and when was the last time they had like a full negative screening or a treatment for an STI. Because really, like when I was learning in my program to be a sex educator, our instructor was like, you know what, STIs are kind of like, just if we could think about them as like a common cold, this would be a much better world, because we would have people understanding that, okay, now I've got some kind of infection, I'm going to go get treatment. I mean, maybe the common cold's not a great example, because doctors don't really do much for you then. But I think also we can think of how like our attitudes towards health have shifted during the pandemic as well. And so I think a lot of people are more likely to try and seek care now that we realize cold symptoms can be indicative of something more serious than just, you know, a regular virus. But yeah, I think the more normalized, the better. And I think there's always going to be people probably who don't necessarily take as many precautions as they could. I mean, I'm one of them as well. There's always moments where you think back to yourself and go, oh, I could have practiced my sexual health a little more maturely, perhaps. But also knowing that it's like, it's a journey, it's a learning opportunity for everybody. So yeah, I think the more normalized, the better. And I don't think that's going to have like a downward negative effect on health.
Thank you for that. I would agree with that. That's, you know, you bring a really interesting perspective. I think this was something, that conversation we had in the last episode, that came from some of like my experiences, just like dating and heterosexual men being a bit like laissez-faire about condoms, which of course they always are. But I feel like now, but bringing up the STI thing isn't like an indication if they are saying like, oh, well, they're all treatable or curable. I feel like that's less about that being a sentiment people hold and more about, you know, straight men sort of weaponizing that as a way to like not use a condom, which they, you know, are always have been trying to do like forever. But you know, you bring, make so many good points about how normalizing STIs will just only have like the positives completely outweigh any possible negatives. I just wanted to jump in quick about something you said, talking about like disclosure and how, you know, the destigmatization of STIs will make people more open about disclosure. And I wanted to ask you if you could share with us and our listeners the best practices, you know, in your opinion, for disclosing STI status and sexual history with like potential new partners.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. And I also really appreciate your comment about how cishet men will weaponize this information. I think that maybe is a good response to the earlier question by Juliana. Is it's not that normalizing the conversation is going to be bad. It's just that when anything becomes mainstream and knowledge becomes, you know, accessible, there are going to be people who use it against others. So that's a really good point. Thank you for making that. But yeah, like best practices and disclosure. I think it's a really helpful way to look at it. Like, no matter what, if you've never had an STI infection in your life, you always use condoms, you should still be having these conversations. So I think a little STI, a sexual health disclosure before engaging in any sexual behavior with another person, I think is mandatory and should be encouraged amongst amongst all people. So there's normally two ways that I talk about this and how you can do it. I would say if we're using terms like best practice, probably I would say the best practice is to have the conversation outside of a sexual context. And I say this just because when you've got your hormones going, you're excited about someone, that is going to impact your decision-making. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, you know, you're horny, you want to get it on. Like, I respect that and I support you, but it can definitely impact how many details you can even remember to recall and how much information you're actually remembering and being able to communicate properly. So a lot of sex educators recommend having that conversation before you are in a sexual context. And, you know, this I think is really good on paper, but I think a lot of people, especially if you're about to have sex with someone for the first time, or you're just getting to know someone, it can feel a little forward to just all of a sudden bring up like, hey, by the way, like, let's have a sexual health conversation. And then the person might be like, oh, you're being very presumptuous that we're even going to need to have that conversation. So that can be a little tricky. I think that this one depends on rapport with the person that you're engaging in whatever with. The one that I happen to do more often, which I don't know if it's a better way, it just is the way that I've been finding myself engaging in STI disclosures, is when, you know, the moment is heating up a little bit, maybe you're making out, and, you know, you're enjoying each other's company in an intimate way. I like to sort of take a moment to check in with myself first and be like, okay, like, what's going on? Like, how's my body feeling? I mean, this is easier said than done, right? This is like an embodiment practice that most of us aren't familiar with because we're not taught how to like feel in our bodies, right? Like, we're always very up intellectually overstimulated, anxious, right? You've got a lot going on. But first I like to do that. I like to check in with myself, just pause for a moment, maybe take a step back from like the whatever you're doing, your little foreplay situation. And if this is, I only recommend this because I think this is more accessible to people. In a flirtatious way, I say like, so like, what do you think about having a quick STI or sexual health conversation right now? And you say it in just kind of like a, in a sort of sensual way. And I find it never interrupts the moment. I have found from my personal experience too, that it actually is like a further turn on because you're kind of taking control of a situation. You're communicating to whoever you're with, that not only do you care about your own health, but you are considering their health as well. And that's to me very sexy. And so in that moment, either you're in the sensual flirtatious method of STI disclosure, or you are doing the, on paper, really great, like removed from a sexual interaction method. Either way, you've got to this point now. And some things that I think are helpful, I tend to volunteer the information first, and this helps model the information that I'm wanting to receive back. And so I say, hey, so my last STI screening was, say, in January. I was tested with a blood sample and a urine sample. And knowing those two is very important because hepatitis and HIV and syphilis, oh my God, I'm going to have to double check that, but all require of the blood work as opposed to just urine, which is chlamydia and gonorrhea. And then also, like, if I've happened to have like an oral swab or an anal swab as well, like these are also additional components of being able to screen properly. I'll offer all those information. I'll offer, so like, I've had these tests, and then I'll explain to them the results. I'll say they were all negative, or in the event that I had a positive screening, I'll explain that, and I'll go through my treatment with them. And I, again, like I did say the word negative there. So I know it's really colloquial to say I'm clean, but again, if we're having these sex positive conversations and we're trying to reduce stigma, obviously words like clean, because the opposite of that, of course, is dirty. We're trying to avoid, right? So I say I'm negative. And then I'll say, if it's relevant, I'll say, since that screening, I've had sex with this amount of people. I did use a condom, or I didn't, and, you know, depending on what happened. And I'll just try and volunteer as much information as I can. And then I'll ask them to like report that back. And then when someone responds to you, this is really your position as a sexually autonomous person to be evaluating what they're telling you. You can have really good chemistry, but not really like what they've said. Like, oh, they can't remember last time they had an STI screening. Well, maybe it's something now that you're not comfortable with. And perhaps you can say, well, how about, you know, I'm due for one. How about we go in together? How about we get an STI screening together? And then once we've got that figured out, we can come back to this intimate moment we're sharing, right? Or maybe that doesn't bother you and you move forward. But I think it's important to empower folks to realize that like they are making a decision each time they move forward or take a step back or pause, and they are the ones in charge of those decisions.
That was a very well laid out formula for us.
Oh, good. I hope so. I feel like I was all over the place there.
No, that was very, very helpful, very informative. I learned a lot, or it was good for me to listen to it too. So I'm sure that our listeners will also appreciate all the wisdom. And I'm mindful of time, and I know Phoebe has some questions about sex beyond the binary and inclusive sexual health education. So Phoebe, do you want to just jump in and ask a couple questions before we run out of time here?
I thought, you know, maybe you could just explain to us what sex ed beyond the binary means to you, and again, why you think that is an important thing to include, and as we sort of look towards revamping sexual education and the way we look at sexual health.
Totally. Thank you so much. I appreciate that question a lot. So yeah, just off the bat, like, I'm a non-binary sex educator, and so it's very important for me to relate to the material that I am teaching with. And it is unfortunate that the vast majority of sexual health resources are very binary. And by that, I mean, they focus on cisgender people and they focus on heterosexual relationships. And so something you run into actually a lot is when you're only teaching sex ed that is talking about how cisgender heterosexual people are having sex, you are not relating to, you're not teaching people who are having sex outside of those parameters. So queer youth are some of the most likely people to have unplanned pregnancies and STI transmissions, because sure, they're sitting in a classroom learning how to put a condom on, but if we're not using terminology that's inclusive of all genders and all sexual orientations and all sexual behaviors, then that you're not going to get through to that student. I mean, we already know that like classrooms are overtaxed and teachers don't have the resources to be delivering adequate education in many cases. So having language that is actually suited and tailored to the students you have in your classroom is so integral to being able to communicate what that looks like. And so I think that alone, that example of the unwanted pregnancies and the STI transmissions is a great warning. It's a really robust example of how binary education fails queer youth, right? And I think especially when we're talking about the political climate that we're in with the, rise of white supremacy and fascism in Canada and the USA, I think the USA is obviously a really explicit example. We've got headlines every day of anti-drag queens and transphobic legislation being introduced and being passed. I think it's a moral responsibility of anyone who is a practitioner of sexual health, and that includes nurses, teachers, any social service provider who is engaging in any way in sexual wellness, it's their moral obligation to be as inclusive as possible and in radical ways. So ensuring that when you are offering services, how gendered is your language? Are you a women's health clinic? Because if you are, I'm probably not going to feel super comfortable going in. How are you communicating the services you have to your students, to your patients, right? Because sexual health is a very political realm. And the more pushback we are seeing by the state and by misogynists and by transphobic people, the more we have to come together as a community and create solidarity and these networks of normalized conversations and of resources, and really just ensuring that when we are having these conversations, we're not talking about men and women, we're talking about people who are sexual beings, many of them are. And so figuring out how we can tailor what we're talking about towards the audiences that are actually needing our resources.
That's exactly some of the stuff we talked about in our last episode too. The way, sexual health, I did some research and how it's so, how the binary of sexual health really excludes and fails trans people. And I like what you said about sexual health being politicized, and that's so true. Yeah. And, because I feel especially femme bodies specifically are also very, obviously very politicized. So much to chew on there. Thank you so much, Sophia. I want to just give you a final word, anything you want to say, and also tell the people where they can find you. Promote yourself, please.
Thank you so much, Phoebe. I appreciate it. I just want to say again, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. It's been lovely to talk about this topic. It's one of my biggest passions. If I could say anything as a closing statement, I just want people to be gentle with themselves when they're talking about these things and trying to navigate this journey, because as we've discussed, adults and youth are not equipped. We're not set up for success a lot of the time when we're trying to navigate our sexual health. So, have these conversations with your friends and with your comrades and with trusted members of your community. Try and be as critical of resources you can, when you're, trying to identify sexual health information online, trying to find accredited institution. I think media literacy really comes in to a lot of that as well. But just being gentle and letting yourself explore some things, right? Figuring out what feels good to you, what doesn't feel good. These are both really important things. And not on the one hand, obviously sexual health is a really serious topic when we talk about personal safety, and things like that, but it's also doesn't have to be so serious. If you are wanting to have an STI disclosure with someone you think is really hot, you can mess it up a little, right? You can be a little awkward, and that's part of the sexual journey. We don't have to be super hot 24/7, right? That's not realistic. And so I would just, my advice is just to be playful and investigate on your own terms, right? And explore and hopefully find out more about yourself through that exploration. And you can find me on Instagram at pleasure Nature Anatomy. That's my little sex ed account that I'm slowly building up.
Yes, everyone go follow to get more amazing insights about sexual health and sex education beyond the binary, of course, from Sophia. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. Be sure to tune in for our next episode. We're on every other Tuesdays here on CITR at 10:30 a.m.
And you can find us on Spotify. So if you want to re-listen to this episode, re-listen to all this amazing information, or share it with your friends who you think would also benefit from this conversation, you can find us there too. Yeah.
Yeah. Just search up Intersections. All right. Bye.
Thank you.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to Intersections by CITR's Intersectionality Collective on 101.9 FM. We would love to be reached by email at intersectionalitycollective@citr.ca or on Instagram at intersectionality_CITR. Send us your comments, feedback, and episode ideas. You can also find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program, and our theme song is provided by Young and Sexy. Tune in on Tuesday at 10 a.m., 2 weeks from now, for the next episode.